Trek oddities. You occasionally see the most goddamn things on a racetrack. I have encountered twin snakes lazily sunning themselves in the desert summer sun on the first lap of the morning. They did not last but two laps before they were flattened and shredded by manic attacking motorcycles. I have seen a handful of $20 bills floating in the afternoon breeze in turn one at Sandia Motorsports Park, where some foolish racer dropped his wallet on the track. I have watched countless other riders skid down the track on their ass, sometimes in front of me. I have also seen a bike on fire, birds in the racing line, good friends tumbling into turns, and a man unplugged from his IV just as he jumps aboard and rides his bike to the starting grid. Each of these is a footnote to the pursuit of the checkered flag. Thanks, guys.
The lights are on red. We're away.
Hey, it's Jules Cusack, Motor POD. That was from the book Wrenched and read by its author, Ed Milich, who was at the Ace Cafe last night on Saturday. Because, yes, I realize it's Sunday the 20th and we were 2 days late with the show. What happened is, as Jim and I did a call as usual, and I was finishing up the edit on the show, a whole bunch of new content came in, including Adam Silver talking to Don MD about their amazing Rossi R1 project. Then as that was going in, I got a tweet about Mark Gardner, who we mentioned in this episode, being at the Ace and doing a reading from his book, Riding Man. So that is why the show is delayed. I hope you enjoy all the extra content. And since we're going to be gone for a short time, well, for a few weeks, that I hope the length of the show doesn't bother you. You can listen to it over the winter vacation. Now I'm going to drop right into the call that I had with Jim, which is going to sound a little strange because it's almost like going back in time. But hope you guys can keep up. I guess it's kind of like a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. My name is Jim Race. I'm here with Jules Cusack. This is episode number 208, and today is December 18th. Good evening, Jules.
Good evening. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you very much. We've got this show is all about feedback, isn't it?
We have an interview with Gavin Emmett from MotoGP.com. But yeah, we would probably like be looking for something to talk about, and we will talk about the 2012 regulations which got solidified this week. But the primary thing is the mountain of email.
Good God! I mean, Jules and I have been talking back and forth. We're pretty sure that this is by far the most monumental avalanche of email that we've had. You know, specifically, we're speaking about the movie episode that we did last week. And you people, you're paying attention.
Yeah.
You missed everything that we missed, and you gave us even more. And we're actually looking at it and looking forward to a whole bunch of new stuff neither of us has seen, right?
And we'll go through this feedback so that everybody benefits, and also I'll update the motorcycle movies page on the MotoGPOD site. So let's just get right into it.
Fire away. Yeah, you're going to hear a lot of names here, folks, and so pay attention and keep your ears open because you'll probably be in this one.
Yeah, that's right. First off, we obviously totally messed up on the Great Escape, and we got called by a lot of people. Steve McQueen did all the stunts of the motorcycle except the actual jump, which was done by a gentleman named Bud Ekins. A bunch of people wrote up. I think the first person that wrote to us about that was Dutcher Styles, so congratulations, Dutcher. You were the first to beat us up about that one. And then Doug Loxton and Martin Darlington, Jim McDowell, Tim Liley, and then probably a couple of few other people that pointed out our error there. So thank you for pointing that out. And Jim, you found a great link that you showed me the other day of a recreation of that jump that BBC did, right? Or somebody?
Yeah, no, it was BBC, and we should probably include that in the show
notes. Please send me that link, and I'll make sure that's in the notes.
Okay. Yeah, it was very cool, and it's done on one of the recreate. I can't remember the name of the frame, but it was essentially recreated Triumph with like a new custom frame, and it was pretty cool the way they set it up and actually did it. So,
okay, Drew Firth, who also told us about Ticket to the Limit a couple weeks back, wrote in about a film called Continental Circus, and he says it's epic. It's a 1969 film. We'll have a link to that. I actually think I may have seen this film from the description that I read. It sounded familiar. So,
anytime somebody says it's epic with an exclamation point, you know, you have to chase it down.
Yeah, yeah. And then Chris Cochran, Steve Jones, and Jim McDowell all wrote in about Little Foss and Big Halsey. I think it was made in 1970s.
Early 70s.
It's got Robert Redford in it, and it's supposed to be kind of cheesy, but good. Good.
Cheesy is good.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, Steve Jones also mentioned that there was a sequel to Easy Rider called Easy Rider, The Ride Back. And Steve, you're going to hell for that one.
You know, sequels are always a little bit difficult. Jeff Janes wrote in with Riding Solo to the Top of the World. Now, I'd heard about that, but I hadn't watched it before. He says it's a film about filmmaker Gaurav Jani. And boy, I'm probably going to get mauled for mispronouncing that. Solo motorcycle journey from Mumbai to one of the most remotest places in the world, the Changtheng Plateau in Ladakh bordering China. And there is a YouTube video that covers a bunch of that. So make sure you take a look at that.
Yeah, we'll have that in the show notes.
Yep. Celeste wrote in, 1 week, and I've never heard of this. It's a Canadian flick about a guy who is told he has cancer and only has a short time to live. He buys an old Norton and rides across the country. It's become one of my all-time favorite movies. It really explores how riding alone gives you the time to be introspective and really get to know yourself. And, you know, I read that when she wrote in. And, you know, the first thing, I forget off the top of my head, and I apologize. I think it might have been Steve that about when I mentioned last week about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. But that was kind of the thing, you know. It's like when you spend time alone with your bike, and like those zoning out moments when you're in your garage or you're riding, and you just kind of get into your own head. And I read that description of it, and I totally understood and realized. So I'm definitely going to watch that. Tim Bennett, Troy Martin, and I can't believe that we forgot this. And frankly, Mark's probably going to kill me because I know that he listens to the show. One Man's Island by Mark Gardner. Mark went over to the Isle of Man. Decided that it was essentially what he was going to do. He decided he was going to race the TT. He writes for Road Racer X, one of our favorite places and definitely a MotoGP OD supporter. And sold everything, you know, kind of like, you know, Liam in a way, and pursued his dream. And went and raced and did pretty well. But, you know, racing the island is not, by any stretch of the imagination, child's play. We had that interview with Sean Harris last year, who, you know, got basically torn apart by that. And by the way, who is going to be racing again next year?
Oh, wow. Really?
I have been talking to Sean Harris from New Zealand, or one of those places down there. Boy, I got beat up on that too.
You did.
It's a fantastic film. And if you haven't seen it, have you seen it, Jules?
No. I've seen it. But it was always like at the Ace or some other place where there's a lot of noise and beer, you know.
But
Troy Martin also wrote in that it was first a book, and so I'm gonna get the book because that would be a really nice way to really get into the subject.
Indeed, the book is great as well. So if you go to www.ridingman.com. Or www.onemansisland.com. Pick it up. Mark's a great guy. He's on a book tour right now of the west coast of North America, kind of heading up towards Seattle. I'm not sure if he's done yet. So I cannot believe I forgot that. Firewake, because the next one I've seen.
Okay, so yeah, Troy Martin and Travis Hinton both wrote in about Troy's story, which is about Troy Bayliss. And not about Troy Martin. And I actually have not seen this. And we, you know, there were some movies that I was aware of that a bunch of people wrote in about that are not even on this list that we're going to read, that, or I mean DVDs that didn't quite make my cut of what I consider like a real documentary film that it really has a story, because you know like season reviews and I mean we could include, you know, all the instructional stuff and, you know, how to set up your suspension too, they would get totally insane. And this one, I just felt like it wasn't, it's not like Fast. Fast is a documentary, but it's got a kind of a different rhythm to it.
Yeah, no, I think it is good. And it's it does tell a story. And it also carries a bit of documentarian. I think I can't remember when it came out, and it's been about 4 years since I've seen it, so it's been a bit. It was prior to his win at Valencia. That much I seem to remember.
Right. And so obviously prior to his final championship.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, we talked, that was one of the things, you know, we were getting a lot of feedback about, you know, the various season reviews and instructional videos and all that. And, you know, you mentioned last week that weren't happy so much with the season reviews. And I think I sent you a link because you noticed this year they actually broke the season reviews up into two separate videos.
Yeah. I did see that. The whole evolution thing.
Yeah, I was actually like really pumped. So what we're talking about is this year they've got MotoGP on a single video, and they actually have the 125 and 250s as well as like a bonus pack or whatever on separate videos. So I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Brian Lama wrote in about a film called Pray for the Wildcats, which because of the cast, I'm going to have to see, because it's a motorcycle movie that has Andy Griffith, William Shatner, Angie Dickinson, and Robert Reed. And they're riding dirt bikes in Baja. It just sounds perfect.
I wonder if Shatner sings.
Or does poetry?
So moving on to Alan Clarkson Dodds. Thank you. He writes in a fair amount.
Yep.
And Jim Walker as well. One Man's Dream. And I forgot about that. I think I've seen bits of it. It's the story of John Britton, and certainly something that people should grab. Not sure exactly where it's available, but if you can pick it up, definitely do so. Our very prodigious typing friend Martin Darlington, as well as Lewis Cox, turn us on to No Limit, 1935.
Yeah. It's a film about the TT.
Yep.
And that's another one that I absolutely want to see. So thanks very much, guys.
we're starting to roll into the I'm going to let you do the next one because I can't stomach it.
Okay. Well, Lewis Cox, Paul Pacey, and Big John Hart wrote in, hey, how could we have forgotten about the ultimate, you know, Fast and Furious version on two wheels, which is the Biker Boys? And I actually did see this film, but my mind managed to somehow, you know, evacuate it from my from my memory banks until you guys reminded me. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, for putting that back in there.
Yep.
Did you actually go to the theater?
No. Okay. I saw it like way after. I think I may have seen Torque and that one at the same time, which may be why they like, kind of got merged or something in my head. You know?
I saw Torque. I forced myself to avoid Biker Boys because I just could not stand the name, and I knew it was going to be horrible. So I'm sure there's somebody out there that perhaps listens to us, maybe some of our stunner friends that are like, but dude.
To be fair, these three gentlemen that wrote in about Biker Boys, wrote in as a, like, please put this on the avoid list.
Right,
like,
right.
They're not like, dude, you got to watch this movie. And then Paul Pacey wrote in, I never even realized this, but apparently Tomb Raider, which I have never seen, features some really great stunt riding on a TRX 850. So we'll put that in the you know, movies with motorcycle scenes, like significant motorcycle scenes in it.
And I read that, and I was, is it TRX 850 like a TDM 850? Is that the same bike? I meant to look it up at the time when we got that email, but I forgot.
Well, why don't we slow down right in here and look it up?
Okay, hang on. We'll do this live.
We'll do it live.
Live. TDM. Oh, no, TRX, sorry.
So if you go to the Wikipedia page for the TRX 850, yeah, it's derived from the Yamaha TDM. You want to jump back in and say that?
Yeah, fire in.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so in the TRX 850, and I've got a good friend, Chuck Boatwright, who I haven't talked to in forever. Chuck, if you're out there, give me a call. it's derived from the TDM 850, which is like probably one of the more oddball bikes that are out there. It's a super cult following.
Yeah, they kind of look like a Duck SS 900 SS, like, you know, late 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And
unique, and I'm not surprised that they used it for a movie because it does look pretty cool. How's your Hyper doing, by the way?
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
We haven't really mentioned that. I did finally decide on a motorcycle despite being, you know, pummeled by both Jim and Liam about 2 or 3 months ago. Yeah, and I ended up with a 2008 Hypermotard S model, black. And I love it. It's fantastic. It's fantastic.
Yeah, you did a pretty cool YouTube video that you should maybe we'll throw that in the show notes too. The one up Mount Hamilton, I think that was really cool.
Oh yeah, actually, why don't I just throw that in? It's just, you know, it's a follow up to the movie thing.
Yeah, people can perfect, right?
Yeah.
People
yeah.
can make more fun of us or you. Well, you know, it's funny because I think I mentioned the other day on the show that I was going to pull my old Nikon F1 out, and I found it today because that one has all the f-stop information and shutter speed written on the bottom.
Right.
So I need to send that to you as well. Anyway, where were we?
So then, Robert Howlett wrote in about an Australian classic. He said called Stone. I looked it up on IMDb. It looks actually pretty interesting, and very difficult to get in the States. But if you're in Australia and haven't seen it, or I think it may be available in the Europe as well, some regions. So that looks pretty interesting.
Cool.
And then Lewis Cox, I love this. He wrote in, don't forget a close shave, Wallace and Gromit. And it's true. They're on the motorcycle there, you know.
Indeed.
And then the final two things are, so Tim Lilly wrote in about this website, MondoEnduro.com, and he describes it as this is the long way down on the cheap. And I went and checked that out. That looks really cool. There's a lot of stuff there that looks amazing. We'll have in the show notes. Definitely check that out. There's a lot of cool videos of people actually, you know, doing adventure riding, and but, you know, without that support crew. I mean, like, Long Way Down, half of the show was about the race of Dakar, half the show was about the support crew breaking down all the time, you know. I mean it's they had such a huge budget and such massive support from a team in the UK and on the road. I mean, a lot of people do this completely on their own. So and at this website there's a bunch of DVDs available, and they all look very cool.
I forget the, and this is really bad on my part, but he's an American. His first name is Joshua. I forget his last name, but he's going to be running it again this year. You said last but not least, and certainly not least, because this and damn you, Stuart Fraser, because yeah.
I had three sleepless nights already because of this link.
Yeah, you sucked me in, and boy, is this a great one. And, you know, this is the kind of thing, Jules, that I really appreciate about doing this show, because we get so much good information, but sometimes we get such jewels and you're like, holy cow.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of them. He sent us a link to vintagebike.co.uk with a bunch of old racing videos from Isle of Man and various races around UK and Ireland. And
some of it shot on Super 8, some of it shot, you know, shot on 16, and unbelievable to watch, just unbelievable.
And all free. And so, Stuart, you get the MotoGPOD link award of the week.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Yeah, it's comprised of a hearty slap on the back and a virtual pint tilted in your honor. So very cool. Very and cool. That will also be in the show notes as well, and we'll probably take their site down.
Yeah. Okay, so that does it for the movie feedback. There's also one other email, which was Carl Hunt wrote in and asked, do you know what the testing schedule is for MotoGP over the winter, spring, and what testing will be televised? And I didn't know the answer.
So
especially about the televised bits.
There is none. Or at least as far as I know. So the IRTA test in Valencia has been, has always been known as race zero.
Right.
That will not occur this year. And that was one of the places where they actually ran for the Beamer, right? You know, the fastest guy at race zero. And it's essentially only three, at least for the premier class, there's only three tests this year. There was a test at Valencia right after the race, the last race of the year. There is a test in Sepang, February 3rd through 5th, and then another one at Qatar. And that's it.
Yep.
That's March 17th through 19th, 3-day test.
And that February one, the first February one, is actually the first day is only for test riders. It's not even for the official riders, the team riders.
That was the rookies thing that they came up with because they had a bunch of concerns about that.
Right.
Because, you know, the teams were coming in. Actually, I didn't mention there were two tests. There's 3rd through 5th and 24th through 26th. But the curtailed schedule is like, pretty much freaking everybody out. But the nice thing is they can use whatever engines they want. Then they don't have to seal their engines until the beginning of the year. And we've been trying to follow this whole engine saga forever and having some great conversation with David Emmett. And thank you, David, about what the restrictions and, you know, possible permutations of it are. It's going to be crazy next year. But the Moto2 guys are busy. They're way busy. They just finished up at Almeria.
Yeah. Yeah, they had testing there. Yeah. How'd it go?
It sounded like it went pretty well. You know, it's interesting because with Aprilia's bow out, FTR has seriously stepped into the fold. So they've pretty much picked up all of the Aprilia or teams that were working towards Aprilia. Not all of them. They had eight signed when we were talking, or not signed, but they were talking to. Now it's down to six, but they're also working with the Spanish CV folks. So they didn't talk about times, and I think that's totally justified because they don't have the engine yet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the point? And Almeria is not a GP circuit. And it's a very common circuit to test at because it's got pretty much a real mix of everything, including a fair amount of bumpy parts.
Doesn't Len Padilla do track days there?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, I think he sent us a video once of him going around that track. It's very flat, but looks very interesting in terms of layout.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a really big go-kart track from when you look at it. Certainly not a true GP circuit, but a great test track for people to run at. You know, the Moto2 stuff is like cranking away, and I think people are, frankly, they have no restrictions, so I think people are testing everywhere. These bikes are, there's probably a Moto2 bike on the track every day when it's not raining, or even when it is.
Right. Frankly. Yeah, why not? They're going to have to do it.
More power to them, and you know those bikes are being refined day after day after day, and you know, there's a lot of people that are like, oh, you know, they're not as fast as the 250s, they're not as fast as the World Supersport bikes. That's today.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That is not going to be the case when we're looking at down the road when the bikes come out. And, you know, even if it is, I don't give a shit because.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we just want to see good racing. I mean, 125s can show us great racing. That doesn't mean that they're faster than something, you know?
there's an awful lot of really good riders that are going to be in that class, and there's no doubt that it's going to be hammer and tong, and I'm looking forward to it.
I mean, I realize that, like, It's almost hypocritical to say that because we're at the same time we always want to see the technology pushed forward. But when I want to see technology pushed forward, that doesn't mean the bike's going faster and faster and faster. They could be becoming more efficient, you know, more the tires getting more grip. I mean, it doesn't have they may be going around the track a little bit faster eventually, but you know, the technology takes many forms. The result doesn't have to be, you know, top end speed or horsepower even.
Exactly. And frankly, Chassis development is chassis and aero development is something that's been neglected for a while. You know, we've kind of fallen into this formula that is prescribed for an I-4 four-stroke, and nobody has done any real innovation for a while. And I think there is room for improvement, and I would like to see what people can come up with when you're restricted to a very specific engine size. So I think we might see some really neat stuff. People are going to be, you know, going for that very cutting edge things. And I think even though these aren't, you know, major motorcycle manufacturers, I think this will still bleed out to the bikes that you and I can ride today.
And it'll also bleed out to the MotoGP class, which is also going to be, you know, changing to a somewhat similar format in 2012, because, well, the formula is changing, and Moto2 is kind of a good testbed for that, I guess. I mean, they're not going to be getting a spec engine, but there's going to be a lot more limitations on the motor.
I think that was your best segue ever.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I don't want to spend too much time talking about the 2012 regulations, because we'll have plenty of time in January when we come back. But there was a really good article that Dennis Noyes wrote. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've read that twice. I had to read it through again. And thank you, Dennis. Your stuff, I may not agree with everything all the time, but man, that one hit home all the way around.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep it simple.
That's basically, yeah. You know, and we talked about that a bit too, not like two or three episodes.
Yeah. No, it's totally true. I mean, I think that the hardest thing, the most expensive thing about R&D is changing variables.
Exactly.
You know, floating variables. So a bunch of people actually wrote in, you know, over the last few weeks, listeners have wrote in and asked, you know, like saying, you know, we're changing, are we going to be changing, you know, specs every 5 years now? Because the 990s lasted 5 years, 800s are going to last 5 years. And, you know, prior to that, we had, and I talked with Gavin about this, is, you know, prior to that, we had a very gradual evolution of a 500 cc class with two strokes and four strokes allowed, so we'll save that for later, but it was made official that's this week.
Do you ever wonder if the MSMA is like, because, you know, we hear this stuff like, you know, give us stability, and then they stab themselves in their own pocketbook by creating the need for a rule change. That whole relationship just baffles me sometimes.
It is a weird one. You know, for a long time, it was kind of a common, I don't know how to say this, but like, I mean, like almost everybody, when they heard MSMA in their heads, they would just thought, oh yeah, Honda, you know?
Yeah.
Automatically. I really don't think that's the case. I think I don't know, maybe the FIM should not be so technical and worry about more about, you know, tracks and regulations of that sort. I like the 2012 rule of a very specific, you know, piece of the engine being limited, which is the stroke in this case, the bore. And
We talked about that too 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and just that, and the four cylinder limit, and the CC limit.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. That's a very small, succinct set of regulations, you know. But
I mean, what he was talking about with the rev limit, and thinking essentially that was what they were going to have to come up with to provide the final, you know, notch in the plan. I kind of agree with, and I understand the rationale behind it. And I'm not sure if, you know, you can bring enough. It's sort of like it might be one of those blocks. So anyway, folks, definitely look at the link in the show notes, because it's a must read article.
Yep.
And it'll give you a whole bunch of good insight as to, in fact, and it's a very technical article. And, you know, hats off to Dennis for that. We try and be technical, but Dennis can like break it down real good.
Yeah, and actually, I'll also link the David Emmett's summary, because that's a really excellent translation of all that technical stuff into more layman terms. I mean, David understands this stuff very well, but his gift of translating it to the rest of us is quite something. So that's I think those two articles together really got me understanding like what this is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And before that, I was kind of confused. So, you know. Okay, this is Jules from Sunday dropping in. I just wanted to introduce the next segment, which is from last night, Saturday, at the Ace. This is Mark Gardner reading from his book, Writing Man.
My goal in going over there was to go over and qualify for a TT and ride in a TT. That was all, you know, that was all I wanted to do. And I was pretty confident when I set out that I would be able to do it, but it turned out actually it was surprisingly hard to put in a qualifying time. Part of my problem was that I had no talent, and I was a coward. But I was also held back by the fact that the weather on the Isle of Man was terrible when I was there. It was the worst weather ever for a TT practice week. It was almost continuous rain, fog, high winds. It was abominable. And so, in spite of that, or perhaps because of that, I ended up having my best experience in qualifying on a terrible day. So this is what happened on that day. This is Wednesday evening of practice week. We go out to Parc Fermé, where we left the bike, to get ready for our one lap. It's not raining. In fact, Glen Crutchery Road is pretty much dry. One guy has his bike running, warming it up, and is crouched beside it, waiting, and warming his hands on the exhaust pipe. I notice another guy, waiting to start practice. He's fit, but even older than me, a real graybeard. He's in white leathers with a red and blue stripe, sort of an Evel Knievel look, but subtler. And I find myself wondering if this is a really cool retro-styled suit, or if it's actually a suit he's been wearing since the 70s. He's relaxed and laughing with some other old racer. Once again, we stage on dry pavement, but by the time I launch, it's streaming rain. My practice partner passes me on the brakes at Porta Bridge. This is getting old. I concentrate on hitting the apex and get a reasonable drive off the corner. The rear spins up in the wet, but the Honda holds its line, and I have a good run to Braddon Church. At the church, I notice something. The wake of the bike ahead of me is still visible in the standing water on the road. He can't be far ahead. Maybe I have an epiphany, aiming for a late apex, winding the throttle on, and letting the spinning rear tire slide around until I'm pointing down the road. Over the next few miles, riding the CBR as though it were a little dirt bike, I catch and pass several guys. No one passes me. I close on my next victim at the top of Ferragaro. He's in black leathers. Another newcomer, like me, I can tell by the orange vest. Even in this weather, the run down to the bottom of Ferragaro is top gear. There's a hump where the road crosses a stream and it kinks left around a building. It's the hump, not the corner, that limits your speed. The apex marker is a cast iron drainpipe. The first time I came through here, I found it damned intimidating, and that was on a bicycle. I know that I'm going to carry a lot more speed through here than this guy. I plan to pass him on the bumpy straight just beyond. But as I adjust my speed and commit, Mr. Orange Vest panics and brakes extra hard. Leaned over in the rain, with the bike unsettled by the bridge, there's no way I'm stroking the brake. I literally squeeze through the gap, brushing the drain pipe with my left shoulder and brushing him a little harder with the CBR's muffler. When I look back, I'm relieved to see that he's still on his wheels. At the tricky 13th milestone, who passes me? The guy in the white leather. He just sits on the bike, knees prim, without hanging off at all. Old school. I appreciate his performance. I lose him after a few bends, but in the next 24 miles, no one else gets by. Once again, I need to slow for fog on the mountain, but it clears and I'm hard on the gas from the 33rd milestone down. Wide open in top gear on the run down from Hillbury, I look up to see a huge double rainbow over my house in Onken. After getting flagged off, I pull back into Parc Fermé. Chris and Carolyn are there waiting, and with only the stopwatch to go on, they had no reason to think I'd had a riding breakthrough. I hit a guy. I yelled to be heard over the motor and through the helmet. They're wide-eyed. He didn't crash. I'm going to wait and apologize. Mr. Orange Vest is taking his time to finish the lap. In the meantime, who comes over but Mr. White Leathers? I knew you were a goer when I saw you hit that guy at the bottom of Barragaro, he says. He laughs. He's got an English accent, and he pronounces Barragaro the way the locals do. Barragaro. My friends sidle in close, wondering what's up. They hear the guy say, I was just going to follow you. I was thinking, this bloke's putting on a really good show. But when I saw you bump that fellow, I thought, maybe I better get out of here. He walks off saying, you're the best newcomer I've seen here this year. I wish Paul had been within earshot. A moment later, the guy who I hit pulls in and stops. He's met by a mechanic. I leave the CBR with Carolyn and walk over. I tell the rider that I'm sorry I hit him, but it quickly becomes apparent that he doesn't speak English. There's a rapid-fire exchange in what sounds like Spanish between him and his helper. This son of a bitch hit me, or words to that effect. One turns to me and says, Espanol, and I shrug. And then he says, Francais. I do speak French, but I suddenly sense that any apology is going to fall on a deaf brain, so I play dumb. Nonetheless, the two Spaniards, or whatever they are, continue to have an angry conversation, and they seem to want to include me in it. At one point, they switch back into French and tell me, you're supposed to pass on the right. Jesus, where would I start with this guy? Pass on the right. I shrug one last time and walk away. Carolyn laughs her ass off when I relate this comment. Again, it was too slippery to actually put in a qualifying time, but the timesheets show that the riders registered for my race recorded a total of 43 laps, of which mine was the 29th fastest. We're all pretty pumped that for once I'm not right at the bottom of the page. Later on, when I'm decompressing at home, Paul comes grinning into the kitchen from the garage where he's been cleaning the bike and says, hey, check this out. I follow him out to the garage and he points out a large black smear, either dye from the Spaniard's leathers or rubber off one of his tires on the brushed aluminum surface of the Micron exhaust. There you go.
So big thanks to Mark for coming out and reading to us. Good luck on your tour. The next part is Adam Silver from the Northern California Riders for Health chapter talking with Don MD about Don's R1 Rossi project. It's a fantastic looking machine that's going to get auctioned off either at the end of 2010 or possibly early 2011. Well, just let's take a listen.
All right, we're recording with Don MD, and I'm just asking him about the R1 Riders for Health project. So tell me the story, Don.
All right, well, the idea had been in my head for a while. As you know, we've all been working on this Riders for Health activities for a couple years now, and I felt to really get Riders for Health on the map in the United States. We needed a big project, something with a big idea, with big exposure. So I had in my head the idea of Valentino Rossi. How do we capitalize on his fame? And then he's a big supporter of Riders for Health anyway. So what I had the idea was to take the design of Valentino's Five Continents AGV helmet, which is his most famous design, and make a design on a bike that would just kind of be like the big helmet concept, is what I've kind of called it. So about this time last year, I had an appointment set with Bob Starr from Yamaha for right after the holidays. We could get to the holidays, get back, and he wanted to see me. I told him I had this idea for him. So I went and met with him, and he loved the idea. And then of course we had to get, we knew we had to get AGV on board, and we had to get because it was their helmet, and we had to get Valentino on board because it was kind of his design. So the first discussion was pretty much that, yeah, he could get me a bike, but you know, I knew I needed to get all this other stuff finalized. And then through Jeanette at Riders for Health, I had contacted her, and she was going to be in contact with Valentino, and they laid the idea on him, and he came back and said yes, since it was for Riders for Health, he was fine with the idea. But his only stipulation was that they didn't just want us to kind of try to copy the idea with someone, some local painter. It had to be Aldo Drudi.
Wow.
So it's kind of like, okay. So we started making contact.
Did you know Drudi?
No,
before?
Never met him. So we then started making some contact through emails and a few things. And actually, Paolo at AGV, who has since left the company, Paolo Baccarello, they worked a lot with Aldo, so they started helping me make the contact. So we kind of had it kind of coming from a couple places, through Valentino's guys, through AGV. And it took a little while, but we did finally make contact with him, and he said yes, but it was then his stipulation was as long as everything was okay with everybody with Yamaha, because he had all kinds of dealings with Yamaha to do. So there was kind of a whole other round of, kind of checking with all the different people. Eventually we had Davide Brivio, head of the Fiat team. He kind of okayed it, everyone. And I have to say, before it was all done, we'd actually made a lap about twice around with everyone, because everyone just wanted to make double sure that we weren't...
Everyone else was okay with it.
Yeah, everyone else was okay with it. And so we finally did get that all right. But when it was all said and done, Aldo... agreed to not only do this adaptation of the design to an R1, but he donated all of his services to do that.
Wow, that's great.
So, and then initially I was thinking that he was going to paint the bike, but then I found out that it was even higher tech than that it would actually be a graphic wrap, the big decal approach that they're doing now with NASCAR and race cars and all this. And so there was a second company called Pole Position Graphics in Italy that Aldo, they do a lot of the work with, and so we then had to contact them, make sure they would do the work. And so eventually we got a hold of them, and they came back and said yes, they would do it, and it turned out they donated their services for the whole project.
Great.
And so we had it all moving, but while all those discussions were going on, because this that I just explained went on from about February to about August, before it was all done. So in the meantime, I really wanted to make a really nice high-end sport bike, and even take it all the way to the level of making it into a track day bike. So not just a street bike. So we took the R1. I made contact with people that we work with on my parts magazine. We contacted Olin's, Akrapovic, Roland Sands, Bridgestone, Dynajet, K&N, EBC Brakes, EK Chain, Vortex Sport Bike Products. Hopefully I haven't left anybody out. But all of them, and not one company said no. Not one company hesitated.
So cool.
Everyone was more like, thank you, this sounds great.
Thanks,
thank you for asking us. Yeah,
that's great.
And so all the products started rolling in, and it was great. And we got great support. In fact, even the guys at Roland Sands, not only they knew they were going to be mounting these wheels on anyway, so then I didn't really have anyone to get the Olin's and all that stuff on. So they said, no problem, we're going to be ripping the thing apart anyway. We'll do that part of
so
it for
the
you.
So the shop at Roland Sands did all the building at the bottom.
Yeah. Wow, so they did most all of that. And the only thing I had to actually take it into a Yamaha dealer for was we put the exhaust system, the Dynajet Power Commander, and the K&N on. Oh, and I forgot to mention, Yamaha, in addition to the bike, they also kicked in the full set of all of the carbon fiber accessories put in, all the trim and everything. And so the Yamaha dealer mounted all that stuff on for us as well. So between Roland Sands and the Yamaha dealer, Mission Motorsports, we got all of that product installed. And and it was just all set. And so the thing started to come together. But then at one point we got it to the stage where we had everything done except for getting the graphics, and that was, you know, admittedly there would be periods of silence, and you know, it was hard to get kind of updates on where they were. And it was really about maybe Thanksgiving time, you know, late November, when finally we were getting notices, yeah, it's fine. And Aldo started asking, where do we ship the product? And it was coming back. And so
did they take the bodywork and then apply the decals in Italy, or did they send the decals and they were applied here?
No, they did it. And actually, the way that came together was that the my bike had its stock, the yellow special edition bodywork on it, and the people at Yamaha actually arranged to send a whole set of new material to Aldo, and then so all the bodywork was done over there, and then we had to then have it airshipped here. And the good thing about that is that Yamaha is, so we're going to keep that other bodywork,
yeah.
And so when the bike is finally sold at the auction, the new buyer will get the all of that bodywork if he wants to maybe go out on a ride and not risk maybe skinning up this once in a lifetime design we have on it. And to make it into a track day bike, we now of course have taken off all the taillight, the turn signals, and the mirrors, and all that. So all of that stuff will go to the new buyer.
Right.
So from there. So so it's now it's done, and we unveiled it at the Long Beach show, and we just loved the design, because it's it was really amazing how they did the graphics on it. I mean, it's. In fact, there was some paint involved, and what I can see now, the way their process is, that there's a blue. The blue is actually paint, and then the graphics is all applied over that. And don't ask me how they die cut it or got it shaped, but it's just the decal portion is what's kind of laid over the, you know, the fairing. And we even asked them to go ahead and utilize the windscreen, so it's got, you know, the full effect of Valentino's design. And of course then the buyer will get a new clear windscreen as well, but it's all splashed on it. And I think I forgot to mention one other company that kicked in was the Saddleman Seat People, because they have a new seat come out for the R1, a production model, but they, instead of using just the piece of Yamaha has a kind of a piece of bodywork that can go over the what would be the top pad on the seat.
Right.
But what we decided to do instead was we kept the stock little top pad, and when Saddleman was putting their stuff together, they actually restitched it with Valentino's number 46.
That was an omelet.
Is right on the
no tomato. We put the salsa on the side.
Thank you.
We're
getting our breakfast here.
Oh, yeah, breakfast is alright.
Great.
Breakfast is alright.
Would you like another milk?
Yeah, please. Right, it was a non-fat
right
milk.
Not fat. Yeah. You're right back. You got it.
Thank you.
So, it all came together great. People at Long Beach, loved it. And
The Long Beach show a few weeks ago was the, official unveiling of it.
They have a press day on Friday. And so we used the press day, and we were preceded in the launch by the unveiling of one of Ben Spee's actual world superbike Yamaha R1s that they had there. And they did a little interview, in fact, with Ben live to the press. And he was at home in Texas, and then came the R1, and so it had good company all weekend, and just a great great unveiling. And so now we embark on what may even be as much as a year of promoting the bike.
Mm. Well, maybe we'll wrap up the recorded session here. So thank you, Don. Been an interesting chat as always.
Great talking to everybody up there in
MotoGP land.
Much thanks to Adam who sent that segment in. Thank you so much, Adam. Now, I guess we're going to go back into the conversation with Jim now. So back in time we go again.
Oh, very cool. It's, for a week that really hasn't had a whole lot of noise, we did have a little bit of noise. We had, what was the weirdest thing that we had? Michael Chiz?
Yeah, coming back.
In theory. Well, so the Chiz, what was it? C1, I think it was.
Right.
Way back then. And we'll have to see, because this may or may not be a pipe dream, but with the rules change back 2000s, which is the bike that he was developing back in, what was it, like 2004? 2004, 2005.
Yeah, those 2 years, yep.
Yeah.
So remember, he brought it to Laguna Seca in 2006.
Yep, brought Laguna Seca and very pretty bike, and he put it out with the electric bike with the TTX GP last year at Isle of Man. Says that he has, am I saying this with enough trepidation?
Just say it.
Says that he has aspirations to run in 2012. And so, Michael, if you listen, I have sent you an email. Feel free to give me a call. I'd be happy to interview you and talk about your plans. And I'm sure people would love to hear about it.
Definitely. Definitely. Great. So we're going to jump into the interview with Gavin Emmett. It's really a lot of fun. We talked about everything there is to talk about. And
wow.
In 15 minutes. And then when the interview is over, come on back. And we're going to do the we have three Moto Matters calendars to give away. So stay tuned.
Cool. Roll tape.
All right. Hey, this is Jules Cisek at MotoGPOD. And I've got Gavin Emmett on the Skype from the UK. You're in Leeds?
In Leeds, yeah. North of England.
Right. Yeah. And obviously, Gavin Emmett's voice everybody will recognize because if you watch either Speed or the MotoGP.com website feeds, you'll hear Gavin getting all excited about racing.
Myself and Nick, of course, and Nick Harris.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually,
you wouldn't forget Nick. You couldn't forget Nick.
No. And actually, I was going to say, with your little hoarse throat, you're sounding a little bit like Nick right now. So.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that, isn't it? Nick, as you said, Tom Waits, but a bit more Bob Dylan, I thought. It's almost getting there. Winter's definitely here. When everyone in MotoGP gets ill in winter, as they all close down for the winter month.
So I want to go over a little bit about your background, how you got into this gig, because I read up on your website that you majored in languages, and you're like fluent. We were fluent in Spanish and French. I've also noticed that you do a lot of, you seem pretty fluent in Italian.
A fair bit. That's, to be honest, I came into the sport 2001 writing for the website for MotoGP.com. And Spanish and French, that's what I did at university. Italian's come on through the paddock, really, by a necessity to be able to speak some Italian, thanks to the amount of Italians in the paddock. So
right.
That's just something that's come on over the years, really. I have studied a bit as well of that. But obviously it's a big help. Not many of the English speakers or native English speakers do speak many languages. So it does help to get another side of things, you know, in the sport that you get a bit more background knowledge from some of the Spanish riders or the French riders or obviously the Italians as well. So I find it's been actually a help throughout my career.
Yeah, I bet. And I think that there's stuff lost in translation all the time. I mean, it was very evident during the Valentino Rossi celebrations this year for when he won the championship. You know, people were trying to translate, you know, literally what he was saying. And of course, you know, you have to know the culture and a lot gets lost in translation. A lot of the times people say things and then you're like, really, is that what he really said?
Yeah, there's also a lot of misinterpretation sometimes. I've read things go to the extreme of someone almost saying they're going to sign for someone else, but that's just reading one translation of it, and you just subtleties of translation can make a huge difference. So not only, of course, in MotoGP, but in all sports, when you get people who go and do interviews in other countries and then it's either literally translated or not, you know, exactly translated. So sometimes you have to be a bit careful with things like that.
Right.
But it does help. understanding some of the little nuances, some of the things that some of the riders do.
And you're not actually a Dorna employee, but you're contracted to do the feed?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked for Dorna since 2001.
Okay.
And worked till the end of 2008. When I was there at the end, I was director of communications, which is basically in charge of the media center and communication PR output of Dorna. But I wanted to move back to the UK, and that didn't really fit in with that. So I still do, obviously, quite a lot of work with Dorna, So I'm an employee of them, but just on a contract basis. Yeah.
Gotcha. And after the flag, how does that fit into the whole Dorna thing?
Well, it's a Dorna run program. We started that, I mean, you'll know yourself, about the same time you started MotoGPOD, we were doing audio podcasts with Matt Roberts as well.
Yep.
From that, we wanted to offer something different, something we knew people were able to do audio podcasts like yourself and have successful, do great shows with them. And we wanted to be able to use the fact that we do have all these great interviews, we do have all this great footage that we're allowed to use and able to use and maximize it, really. And we know as well in the States that sometimes you guys are a bit shortchanged with the amount of programming you get on MotoGP.
Oh, yeah.
Wanting to offer something to you guys for free, something that's there, something also a bit lighthearted, which is hard to do under the Dorna banner always, because you've got to take into account all their commercial commitments and everything like that. And obviously they're part of the framework of the sport. So there's certain things you have to be careful with. But working with them, working with Red Bull as well, we managed to put together after the flag program, and over time it's changed, it's evolved a bit. It will again in next season as well. Hopefully we're going to be able to do it. This year actually we did it without a budget whatsoever. It was really done, it's really done out of the will of myself and five or six other people who work on it, from cameramen to producers and that kind of thing. And we've done it, really, it's taken out of our own time on a Sunday evening. We put it all together, which is why it does take until Friday to do, because it's people who are fitting it around their other work to put it together and make sure that we still, because we just wanted to keep it going this season. So it was really done on a minimal budget for most of the year.
Right. And yeah, I've noticed that you actually have multiple cameramen, because there's been shots where like somebody's shooting from across the stadium and then there's another cameraman pointing from you at the side. And so it looks like a very high quality production, and it definitely comes out as such. So I'm amazed to hear that it's just, you know, so these guys are the cameramen are people who work for Dorna for like other things. And then you just basically like, hey, you know, got extra time, so let's shoot another After the Flag episode.
No, don't get me wrong. I mean, they work for Dorna. They're there all weekend. They're the ones taking all the footage, whether it be from the interviews or around the track, these kinds of things.
And got it. So it's all the same people. Cool.
Yeah. Instead of them knocking off at 6 o'clock on a Sunday, we carry on and do this program while a lot of the other cameramen go. But there's a couple of us who stay. Obviously, they're contracted to Dorna to do the work, but it is something that we see as an extra program that it does come out as well as of. A lot of people's will of doing just, you know, making the program. But yeah, we have fun doing it. We really do have fun doing it.
Yeah, I can tell. It's got a great atmosphere, and I always look forward to seeing it. I wish it was like one after every single event, but I'm sure you guys can't really pull it off when you have to fly between.
That's the thing. Countries. We get lots and lots of emails saying, oh, it's up late, or how come you haven't got one after this? And just, you know, when we're flying from Australia to Malaysia, you know, you leave Australia on Monday from the race, and then you go to Malaysia, you don't get there till Tuesday, and then you're already preparing for the weekend that's there. And it's impossible for us to create a program in that short space of time. So that's why sometimes we have to do double headers, that we call them, to put two races into one.
Right.
And we just want to make them as relevant as possible.
That's actually a great segue to the next thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, what is this life with the circus really like, you know, for you, because you obviously are traveling to all these different rounds. And, you know, I've heard that this, you know, the paddock is kind of like a little village that, you know, that moves from place to place in the world. And especially when it's in Europe, when you've got the trucks, it really is the same stuff at every track, different facilities and stuff, obviously, but it's always the same people. And what's it like?
Yeah, it is just like that. You've got, I'm not sure whether it's 1,000, 1,500 people who travel to every single race. They're there week in, week out. It's the same people, different climate, whether you're in Donington and it's raining or you're in Laguna and it's scorching. Really is generally the same people who are there. Obviously, the fans are different at every race. Every race as well has people on site at each circuit, and massive amounts of people as well. So they do create their own little atmosphere. But, you know, you get groups of friends, you get big groups as well of people who hang out together. It's a great fun lifestyle. I'm lucky I don't have many responsibilities in terms of family. I'm not sure how some people do it. although I have spoken to some people who are married and say it's a good time to get away from the wife. But I wouldn't like to speculate on who that would be. But I don't know. I don't honestly don't know how some people can do that, who they can be away from their wife and kids. But I suppose it does give them time away. But let's not get down the alley too much.
Right. I think Colin Edwards that flies back a bunch of times during the year, right, to spend time with the fam.
A lot of the riders do. If they've got kids, they like to go back. I don't blame them. It's a real, it's a tough process for everybody. And I have it easy. Generally, I'm at circuits from Wednesday till Monday or Thursday to Monday. But there's people who are going from race to race. There's people who practically are there. They're leaving a week in advance of the race, you know, and there's people who do spend a long, long time away from home.
Yeah, yeah. The parts guys, I hear, have the roughest.
The guys who do the cabling, who set all that up before the weekend, even dreamt of, all logistics people who get there. There's people who miss the race before to go and set up the next race. All the guys who drive the trucks around Europe as well, they're, you know, they've got massive drives usually across Europe to get to their headquarters or to a parking spot in Belgium or strange things like that where they leave things. It's a tall order for many people, but you know, there's a lot of I think there's a lot of will and desire between people. Of course, you're being paid in general, but I think people would be surprised as well if they did see that people aren't paid necessarily well. Compared to what you might expect,
except for the riders,
all of them. I don't look in their pay packets. I just look at the cars they drive when they come into the circuit.
Nice. The younger riders that have to kind of adjust to this lifestyle. Do you see them struggling with that at all? Like, you know, I mean, some of these guys are like, you know, 15 years old, and suddenly they're thrown into this circus where they like, especially those you know, Australia, Malaysia, you know, where you're bouncing all over the world and time zones are changing and you have to readjust your body clock all the time. I mean, it must be crazy.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few of the really young ones at close hand, actually, whether it was Chaz Davis when he first came through. You know, he looked for his parents, obviously came to quite a few races and they make quick friendships. He's really good friends with Casey Stoner, another one who's really young. When he came into the sport, and they do form their little bonds. Like you might see around the paddock, Scott Redding and Danny Webb hanging out a lot of the time because they're young kids who cause their own mischief around the paddock. But I remember in 2001, actually, traveling with quite a lot, just to how things worked out with the junior team, which was Danny Pedrosa, Tony Elias, Juan Olivet. And, you know, they were traveling from 15, 16 years of age, and it was just, they seemed to have, it's like a little adventure for them. They obviously see their career ahead in the sport, but for them really at that age, it's an adventure. What can you do in the sport? And I think there's a good amount of camaraderie amongst the youngsters, and their parents are there on many occasions. Sometimes with some riders, the parents maybe get in the way a little bit too much. Sometimes you wonder maybe a bit, they need to be a bit there a bit more, but in general, I think there's generally a healthy balance, and especially with the young riders, a lot of the people who've been in the paddock a while really want to help them and look after them in some kind of way.
And are there rounds where like you kind of just, you go there and you don't even like leave the perimeter of your little village?
You know, sometimes, that does happen. There are times when it's, I remember, for example, in China, in Shanghai, when we used to go there, you didn't get individual hire cars. You used to be ferried on a bus from the hotel to the circuit to hotel to the airport. You may have the odd time when you could grab a quick moment to get into Shanghai, but because it was 2 hours from, or 1 hour and a half or something like that, you really didn't get in there that much. And you really were, you just, it's amazing. A lot of people think about, there is a lot of glamour involved in the sport, these kinds of things, but a lot of times, and I'm sure you've heard people say it in the past, you do see insides of airports, hotels and circuits and not much else with the same kinds of faces as well. But you generally do still get a feel for the countries. You just don't get to see the country as such.
Right. I actually hear that like a lot of the teams, a lot of the Italians especially, will like look for an Italian restaurant, and they won't even try the local foods, and you know.
Yeah, they're massively keen on finding the pasta wherever they can find it around the world, or a good pizza, that kind of thing, and then complaining when it's not up to standards back home. Yeah, that's quite a common thing. I think we're a bit more adventurous though, the Brits.
Yeah.
But we like to try, we do like to try everything.
Cool. What are some of your favorite locations?
For races to go to, I love Phillip Island. I love going there.
You know, everybody said that's the one. Like, if I ask that question of anybody, they always say Phillip Island. What is it about the place? I mean, it's visually, I know it's gorgeous.
Yeah, and I think that's it, because you go there and you watch the bikes all weekend. And every single lap, be like, wow, this is a great place to watch. It can be an absolutely horrible place as well. When it turns wintry in Phillip Island, we've all seen it there, when it really can lash down there. It's right on the south coast of Australia. And when we go, isn't summertime there, it's springtime. It's coming in to the summer season. So you can have great days there, but you can have absolutely terrible days.
Yeah.
But it is a great place. People are friendly. Because it's an island, it's just off the south of, it's about 2 hours from Melbourne. But there's not many people live on the island permanently. So everyone who's there on the island is there for the bikes in general.
Right, Yeah, I know. I've read accounts of people riding from Sydney.
Yeah.
You know, like over a couple of days, or and you know, encountering snow on the way. I mean, it's pretty amazing, the spirit, I guess, of adventure that the island draws people.
Yeah, it does take people from all over Australia as well, and it's a great race. It's great to go to. Laguna Seca, we always enjoy coming over to California as well, and I've enjoyed actually Indy for the last couple of years. It may not be steeped in motorcycle tradition as such, but steeped in motorsport tradition, and you do really feel it there. You do really get a sense of it. And I suppose in Europe, I think Mugello is the one that people will tell you, like Phillip Island, it's a fantastic setting. It is in the heart of Tuscany, so it's half an hour from Florence, which is a beautiful city anyway. But the track at Mugello is brilliant. It really is brilliant. And how it's, I recommend anyone in Europe to get to Mugello, because one, you see the fervour and the passion of the Italian fans is incredible throughout the whole weekend on the hillsides around there. But the way the track just wends its way around the Tuscan hillsides is incredible. And you, although the Italians look for Italian food everywhere in the world, there you really do eat well, and you do live well outside the circuit. Yeah, they know how to put on a show there.
I hear that it's a bit to get in and out of, though.
It can be. There's only one road either side coming into the track, but you almost take it, because it is a great place to go to. It is.
I mean, Laguna used to be like that too, and you know, they kind of fixed that. But I mean, if you're really if you want to go to a great track, you're going to live through anything to get there, right? So
exactly, you're going to have to fight your way to get there. So and we know how great Laguna is in terms of track as well. So that's another one. I think those three or four places do stand out.
Cool. How do you feel about this whole Silverstone Donington move?
I'm really excited about going to Silverstone. I really am. I'm really sad that we're not going to be going to Donington anymore. it was a track really that was, I'd say, revived by MotoGP, and it became the home. You know, from 1987, it was the home for the British Grand Prix for the bikes. The bikes were at Silverstone before. That's obviously changed considerably. But I think Silverstone had a real big desire to have MotoGP at the track. Obviously, Formula One will be going back there, and that's a disappointment for Donington as well. I wouldn't like to get into, there's a lot of politics and a lot of things behind the scenes there, of course, as you'll have seen with the Formula One decisions.
Yeah.
But I think Silverstone is going to offer up a great track for the bikes. Not so great for spectators, but having spoken to people at Silverstone, they're really trying to remedy that with putting different stands in different places and trying to raise things up a bit higher, because it's so flat there. But the track they're expecting, and having looked at it, looks like it could be the fastest in MotoGP.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I think as well, people have to understand they're making modifications to the track at Silverstone for MotoGP, and F1 is going to have to accommodate those changes for their race that's going to be there, because the changes are going ahead. But it should have a couple of really fast corners.
That's gonna be amazing. I didn't realize it was that much fast of a track. I mean, I've seen Formula One races there in the past, but never bike races. Well, I guess I've seen like some BSB rounds there, but
yeah, of course they've had some BSB rounds on sometimes on the shorter circuit and on the GP track. But it was there back there in the 70s, early 80s, that kind of thing. I was very young then, shall we say? so I haven't seen them myself, but I think they will put on a good show, and there is a great will from the people at Silverstone to make it a good show next season.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the whole show, this was a really fun season. We had a lot of very close. I mean, it was all the classes. I mean, obviously the 250s especially had some really really close championship, and actually, you know, in the races. Can you like summarize the season for as you saw it?
For MotoGP, I'd say what characterized it really. Sometimes we did have some great races this year. There's no getting away from it. We had some that weren't great as well. I think that's really the measure of most seasons, that there are some races where you have to go, okay, wasn't a classic. But I think the thing that came through on this season more than anything was we had four riders who were completely at the peak of their game, riding to the absolute limit. I think Jorge Lorenzo said at one point, this is why the crashes are coming. I mean, I can't remember. I'm trying to remember now, racking my brains. I can't remember a time, though, Valentino Rossi crashing three times in races in a year and it really affecting him.
Yep.
I think he crashed four this year, if we include the crash at Donington where he remounted, that kind of thing. But, you know, having such crucial moments during a season, okay, maybe 2000, maybe 2007, there were a couple of DNFs, but it was because the riders were so much at the limit. Himself, Lorenzo, Casey Stoner, Danny Pedrosa as well, and you really got the feeling that they were having to go beyond themselves, and I think that really came across. Sometimes, you know, it's hard to see that all the riders are at the absolute limit, and I think that became very clear this season for MotoGP, and I think it was thrilling. I think it was really intriguing to watch. It's been funny, hasn't it, watching Valentino Rossi become the elder statesman, becoming the
isn't that the weird? Man.
Yeah, it is really strange becoming the one that the young riders are gunning for, because it was obviously what he was the young one coming through and challenging the old guard. So I think it's great to see the kids, so to speak, gunning for him. And I think it will go on, but at least next season we'll have him racing against the other guys, and we're all hoping, I think, in the sport that it can continue on beyond that. That's something to wait and see for next year.
I know. I'm actually, it's kind of amazing that we're even talking about the fact that he'll be retiring soon. You know,
I really hope not. Yeah. I really hope not. And I'm sure the fans who are watching at home hope not as well. I think he's got other things he'll want to do. He's a really ambitious person, as we've seen throughout the years, and competitive as well. And some people say he'll be motivated by the stats. I don't think so much. I think he'll be motivated by the fact that he does have three riders who are pushing him to his limits and beyond them. He still came out on top this year. Who knows what will happen next year? If it's a winning season for him, who knows? Question marks. If it's a losing season, who knows? So I think we'll have to wait until the middle of next year, and I don't think anyone will force his hand to do anything.
That's so true. That's so true. And I think that he's the kind of rider that, you know, the more pressure you apply to him, the more he enjoys it.
Yeah. He thrives on it. And we all know about he's a clever rider. He, you know, works the media, works the other riders as well. But I think now with the likes of Jorge Lorenzo's happy to try and play those games as well. Casey Stoner seems impervious to some of the games as well. He's just happy with doing things straight down the line. Danny Pedrosa's come on a lot as well in terms of the media over the last year.
He has. He's smiling a lot. You know.
He's really relaxed into it now. He's had some stick in the past about his temperament, but I think most journalists would agree that, you know, he's over the last season he really did change. And again with Casey Stoner as well, changed. I think he's just growing up. They're still young guys, and Valentino Rossi maybe was thrust into that spotlight a lot earlier than those, and maybe came to it a bit quicker. I think Pedrosa and Stoner are settling into that.
Yeah, I think I saw him around the Indy paddock, riding around on a scooter, eating pizza and smiling and just talking to people. It was just it was great. I mean, he also had that win in Laguna under his belt. So, you know, at that time, so I think he was finally starting to hit his stride this season, because it was a tough season for him.
Yeah, it was a tough season for him, and I think for all of Honda, really.
Yeah,
because they didn't get what they expected from Andrea Dovizioso. Of course, Dovizioso changed that suspension in the latter stages of the season to try and see if that helped them. It didn't do too much in the early stages. I know in the most recent test, they were going with both suspension systems and trying to find out between whether Ohlins or Showa. But the fact that Honda even allowed that to happen, I think that actually does say a lot, that they really are desperate to make that step forward. And I think it'll be interesting to see if they can bring something to the table next year.
If they do, they've got a lot of amazing riders. I mean, they've got Melandri and Simoncelli as well, so...
Yeah, and I think there's no doubting their talents. I think Marco Melandri showed last year that it was just a case of himself and the Ducati not getting on.
Yeah.
And you know, I think we'll see good things from him again. If he can get himself in the right place, make sure he stays injury free, then I think we'll get something good out of him. And Marco Simoncelli's been a consistent performer in the 250 class. Just missed out on the title at the end, but he's shown. Well, he showed when he even jumped on the superbike for a weekend that he's pretty adaptable as well.
That was pretty wicked.
Yeah,
that was amazing.
It was really interesting to see as well, though, I think, that he was able to do that, go over there, ride the bike for the first weekend, get on the podium as well. And I think it proved his a bit of the talent that some people might have been doubting.
Yeah, it also proved that I don't think he's ever going to lose that aggressive edge, though, because, I mean, the way he took out Biaggi was...
That was,
ruthless.
He's got a little edge, hasn't he? A little bit of a streak. Some of the riders don't like it too much. I don't think Hector Barber or Alvaro Bautista will be sending him Christmas cards. But he's got a few friends as well, but he's made a few enemies too.
Yeah, and of course Hiroshi Ayama is going to be on a Honda as well, so that should be interesting how he, because he had a rough time with the first few tests.
Yeah, I mean it's not going to be easy. Again, he's not going to be riding the latest Honda at the moment. He's still got to get to grips with the MotoGP bike. We saw how Yuki Takahashi didn't get too much time with the bike last year and struggled with it in the early stages. I think there's maybe a bit more to Hiroshi Aoyama. I think he's proved this season what a talent he is.
What a fighter, too.
Oh, yeah, and a real gritty performer. I don't think we're ever going to know how much work Honda had done on that bike throughout the season or before the season. He still says not too much, and I'm inclined to go with him on that, but it's obviously something. But I'm really intrigued to see him in MotoGP next year. He, again, as you say, he's a gritty character, tough performer, but he's a really good guy as well, and he's thoroughly dedicated to his sport. And I think that people who do put so much dedication in deserve the fruits of the labour, really.
It was really wonderful watching, as the season wound down and the stakes went up, because Simoncelli really came on strong. It was amazing, and because Ayama seems like a very quiet, you know, I met him a few years ago at Laguna Seca, and he's such a gentle guy, you know.
He is very unassuming,
but then you know, that stuff that he was doing in Sepang was just amazing.
I think it's more maybe a national characteristic. A lot of Japanese people are quietly or gently unassuming. They're not too there's not an outpouring of emotion left, right, and centre. But underneath it, there's you know, people, and they're gritty challengers all the time. We have seen it in the past. Daijiro Kato, in the past, I remember he was the quietest, most pleasant person you'd ever meet, but get him on a racetrack and you couldn't hold on to him, you know?
Yeah, he's totally missed.
There's a character, massively, I mean, it's just a character there that I think comes through, and I think it's part of the national psyche, really, in Japan.
Yeah, no, I think it's true very much of Casey Stoner and Australians, too. He's another character who's, like, kind of walled off in a different way, because I think that that Hiroshi is just more humble, whereas Stoner is actually kind of closed. And I think you actually hit the nail on the head a little bit about the fact that they're still kids. I mean, yeah, he's married and stuff, but he's a young guy.
Yeah, he's still young. Yeah. He's just, I think, was it 10, 24 this year, Casey Stoner, but he's been at the top of the game now for the last four seasons or so.
Yeah.
And it's going to take time, and they've been thrust in there from 15, 16 years of age, or
exactly.
missed school throughout a lot of their young years, and just to dedication for the love of the sport. And they're not trained media people. They're just racers who've done really, really well. And you know, it's not a normal lifestyle living in the paddock from being 15, 16 years of age. So I think sometimes the likes of Casey and Danny do get a little bit too harsh a media, when you really have to look at what really have they been through and what are they doing. And they're just people who love to go fast and love to race. And I don't think anyone could knock them for that.
Yeah, and it's obvious, because as soon as they're on that bike, you know, they're magic.
Yeah, yeah, that's where their personalities shine, on top of a motorcycle.
Yep. So speaking of personalities, we've got a garage full of personality in Fiat with Rossi and Lorenzo. And there's been such an interesting, I think this is the first time I've ever seen, like, Rossi really, I mean, he's identified challengers before, and he definitely, you know, has respect for other riders, but it's more than respect. I think there's a little bit of not fear, but he said he put that this ultimatum down, that you got to choose between Lorenzo and I. I'm not going to be developing this bike if he gets to ride it and all this kind of stuff. You know, he gets paid to develop the bike, so
yeah,
it's part of his job.
He's a 9-time world champion.
Yeah.
He can try and lay down whatever law, and it's whether Yamaha stand up to it or whether they don't. It's up to them at the end of the day. They'll be the ones paying the wages. They're the ones who are deciding these kinds of things, and he's just putting his manifesto on the table, I suppose, really. But I think with what he sees in Lorenzo is a young kid with a huge amount of talent. Yamaha have gone down the route of a younger rider alongside Valentino. We had Colin Edwards there. We had, for example, in the past, it was Colin Edwards, wasn't it? Carlos Checa was there, wasn't he, as well? But this time it's the young, hungry rider who's really got to grips with the machinery over the last couple of years, and he does see it as a threat and a challenge. And when you're in that position, you're going to use everything in your armory, whether it's your name, your status, or anything, to make sure you get ahead. I don't think there's ever been a rider in the history of the World Championships that hasn't been on one of the better bikes around, and they wanted to stay that way. And so I think he's just doing everything in his power, and why not? It's all part of the competition. Unfortunately, not everything that happens on the racetrack decides the outcome of the race. There's a lot, as you'll know, going on the outsides as well. And I think they all play their part.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that Lorenzo is playing the perfect game to kind of offset Rossi there, because he's kind of letting it all slide off, and he's putting his own little, you know, bites out there as well. It's really fun to watch.
It's like he's holding up a mirror.
It's very true.
Just saying, this is what you do. I'm going to try and throw it back at you.
Yeah.
The Lorenzo's, he's not, he's really intelligent, really thoughtful rider as well. I don't know if you've read his book at all when it was translated.
I haven't, but one of the listeners wrote me an email just this week and said I really should read it, because it'll give me a big aha moment on Lorenzo.
Massively. I think what you learn from that book is how much of a thoughtful rider is, that the things that he's gone through in his life to get to this situation. But as I say, the thing that comes across more than anything is he's a rider who thinks, not just during a race, but he thinks all the time, and he's permanently thinking. You can see it on his face sometimes when someone's doing an interview with him. You'll see him pause for a couple of seconds, and a couple of other riders might go straight into an answer, but he's thinking already about what he's going to say and how he's going to say it.
Right.
And I like that. I like that he's considered. I think he's had to be taught to be like that, because he has been to see sports psychologists and these kinds of people to help him. But hey, it seems to be working for him.
It definitely is. I mean, you know, when he was coming into MotoGP, I think a lot of fans were like, oh God. I mean, because they were kind of used to his kind of craziness and attitude that he had in the lower classes. And then he arrived and he was all humble and like chill and, you know, and also unbelievably effective.
I think in the 250s, people may have seen a certain side of Jorge Lorenzo as the confident person going on and winning races left, right and center, and confidence in that ability. And I think when he came up to MotoGP, he recognized it wasn't going to be as straightforward, or as, not that I'm saying it was straightforward in the 250s, but it wasn't going to be that simple. And he's come with it with a completely fresh attitude. There was a lot of change around in his management team and things like that as well. And he seems to have come out of it better for it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in my household, he's the other guy that my family has stickers of and T-shirts. And, you know.
he'd love that as well, you know. He does love. He loves interacting with the fans. He does do a lot of appearances, these kinds of things. He does a lot for charity as well. He does try and give things back. He's I think a lot of people have been surprised by him because of what they'd seen in the past from him, but I think he's been pleasantly surprised.
Cool. Yeah. I'm next season is going to be amazing between those two guys.
Yeah, it will be. I think it will be the four of them once more. Whether Ben Spies can get in on the act, that would be great to see as well. But I think without a doubt, you'll get those four up there. That inter-team rivalry will be there. Who's going to seal the contract for the following season, or who are Yamaha going to put their belief behind? That's going to be a side story for next season as well.
Big time, yeah.
It's going to be intriguing.
Very much so. And I think that, you know, I mean, speaking of Ben Spies, he's gunning for the factory team. I mean, he's doing his time on the satellite team, but he's going to, I mean, I think his whole plan is to be on the factory team within a few years.
That has to be. I think that has to be the goal of any rider coming into the sport, from superbikes or from the AMA or wherever. I think that it's going to be very, very hard for anyone to step into a factory team without having proved something somewhere along the lines in Grand Prix. I think, I just don't think it won't happen. And, you've got to do your apprenticeship in such a way, and it's going to be a challenge. It's not going to be easy. What we saw at Valencia was someone who's obviously got, and we know, we've seen it in the AMA, we've seen it in Superbikes this season. He's got a massive amount of talent, and he's just got to keep showing that and keep proving it. We saw from James Tosin, he had a great first season where we were thinking, okay, he really does have talent. He didn't get a factory ride for the following season, but unfortunately, it didn't work out for him this season, and we're having to say goodbye. There's a lot of pressure on these riders to perform very quickly. So I hope that Ben Spies can make the grade, can make that step up, and whether it's into a factory Yamaha team or elsewhere. But he's certainly got the backing of the factory. They certainly want him to prove that he can ride a factory bike for them.
Yeah, and you know he's another one that's very, very smart all around. Not just a good rider, but the way he speaks with the press and he doesn't play games with the other riders, like mind games, like the way some of the European riders might, but he's also totally impervious to it. So that, I think, will give him a bit of an edge over some other riders, you know.
I think going head to head with Matt Mladin for so long.
Yeah, exactly.
Got to have learned a thing or two doing that for those years.
Yep.
So, he's got it all in his locker, I think. And it's a bringing it to MotoGP.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Last thing that I wanted to ask your opinions on was the all the 2012 regulations that are coming down. It's starting to finally get. I mean, I think we finally got like a official FIM release.
About
the bore and the four cylinders and, you know, 1,000 cc's. What a lot of our listeners have been writing in and about, you know, we had like decades of a very simple 500 cc two-stroke formula with some minor changes here and there, but basically, it was unchanged. And now we went through 5 years of 990s. We're going to go through 5 years of 800s. Now we're going to go, we're going to another formula. And, you know, we're trying to save money. Somebody, there's this like thing where people are worried about costs and yet they're changing the formula. You know, there's a lot of R&D that's gone into the 800s that is totally transferable, but there's some that's not.
Well, yeah, I think, look, the 500 evolved from 1949 when Grand Prix started, and they evolved massively year in, year out. They were evolving. There were four strokes at times. There were then two strokes, and that obviously changed things massively. The tires and everything, it changed all the time. The bikes evolved.
They did, but it wasn't. But it wasn't based on regulations, though.
But it got to a point. It's got to a point where the factories are saying, "Look, it's a huge sport. A lot of sports that started, whether it was, you know, a century ago or half a century ago, they've had to change, and you have to change with the times to survive. It's, and I think that's what MotoGP is trying to do. It's trying to change with the times to survive. I don't think it's in too much danger of it, but you have to answer calls then in this modern world. You have to answer calls to television and to marketing and the money. It's a vicious circle, really. You know, you need the money to race, but you only get the money in if you get good TV. You've only got good TV if you get good racing, and it goes round in itself. It's the, you know, it's like a dog chasing its tail, really, because everything's got to fit into place. And it's you with regulations, and I think it's hard, whether it's the FIM, Dorna, MSMA, they've all got this burden on them of finding the magic formula that works, that works for the factories, that works for the federation, that works for the TV. And it's hard just trying to find that magic formula of how things were. When the 990s were there, it was, we all know how great that became. People forget the first couple of seasons, it was Valentino Rossi dominating.
Right.
And really, he was cementing his legend in those first couple of years, really, of MotoGP. So it will take time for a formula to settle down. What's happened this time is, with the financial crisis, that the money, they're thinking, okay, the money might not be coming into the sport in the same way. It's like with, there's thousands of digital TV channels, so the money's spread a lot thinner. There's thousands of different sporting disciplines. The money is spreading out a lot thinner. There is still a bit more money at the top level of the sport, as is MotoGP. So they're just trying to move, I think, with the times. And it's inevitable, I think, that they had to do something. I think it was inevitable. It was the costs are spiraling all the time, and it's an attempt again to find a level playing field and somewhere whereby all teams are able to compete.
And maybe get some more guys, maybe some guys to come back. You know, I mean, I think the hardest thing was losing manufacturers.
Yeah, I mean, losing Kawasaki was, I think, a blow. But for them, there's a lot more to it. Okay, we're not going to go racing, it costs too much. I think there's a lot more to that. In Japan, there were a lot of people at Honda, at Yamaha and at Kawasaki, there's people in certain areas of that company losing jobs. And so how can a company keep going racing, which is in effect a marketing platform for them, when there's people losing their jobs and their livelihoods?
Right.
So it's a big balancing act they have to do there. The manufacturers don't have it easy to keep racing. But again, the new rules may not be as agreeable to them, but hopefully it will be to make the sport and keep the sport being at the pinnacle and keep it successful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it will be successful. I don't really have like a – I think that maybe the 800s were a bit of a mistake, and we could have stuck with like the 990s, like slowly drifting into this kind of a series where it's a little bit closer to production but not enough to, you know, anger the Flamini brothers too much.
Well, I think it just at that time it was because everything was successful. It was almost put on the manufacturers. Okay, these bikes are traveling, and a lot of people still say now, I don't understand how going to 800s was ever going to help, because they're going to be quicker through the corners, that kind of thing. But the theory was there. The bikes are getting too quick. the amount of power that the 990s were producing, it was the tires that were holding them back. They could have gone a lot quicker. And over the last three seasons that we've seen the 800s, I think you can just have to imagine where the 990s could have been.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with the tire war that was going on between Michelin and Bridgestone as well. You can only imagine where they would have been getting to, and who knows how fast they would have been in the corners.
Yeah, and we still probably would have gotten the electronics anyway. So
exactly. I think it's been naive to sort of almost think, okay, we could have stuck with the 990. Something needed doing. It was they went for the 800 cc formula, and okay, it's worked to an extent, but they've seen that in terms of costs and for their satellite teams, they need to do something else. And again, it's always going to be a gamble in inverted commas, but they're trying to do things for the good of the sport. So it's still out there. It's still competitive. It's still a good show because at the end of the day, it needs to be a show to survive.
And I think Moto2 is is a great testing ground for this kind of a approach.
I agree. It is. That's what it is. I mean, the 600 engines they'll be using are race-tuned engines. They're not ones you're going to be able to buy on the streets. They're specific for those bikes. They're based around the CBR 600, but there'll be race-tuned versions of them and put into different prototype chassis. And I think that is what's going to be the test bed, as you say, for MotoGP come 2012. I wouldn't ever dream of thinking, though, that there's going to be a time when the factories aren't going to be leading the game. I think that's always going to be the case. But we'll just have to just remain and see how the balance works for 2012.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for talking to me. And I love being able to hear your voice now on the podcast because I'm so used to it. You know, I watch MotoGP.com religiously. I watch all the races live, which is kind of crazy sometimes because it's like, you know, early.
I don't know how some
hours.
Of you guys do it in the middle of the morning. We get the figures back, people listening, going, all these guys in the USA, wow. But
Are you still like involved in the actual website stuff?
No, I obviously I still work with the. I still deal with the people who run that, but I don't do anything directly on it apart from the commentary and after the flag.
Right. Okay. Because I know that some people have written to like the support and gotten emails back from you, and they were like, "Oh, cool."
Yeah, well, I used to obviously it used to be part of my department at Dorna, but I no longer take care of those kinds of things.
Gotcha. You're one of the guys kind of pushing the new media over there because I see you're on Twitter and you're doing the podcasting stuff, like you know, because you were talking a lot about the TV stuff that you know, that's obviously the biggest moneymaker, and so it's all around like making the show good for TV, the sponsors are happy with the exposure they get and whatever. So before you take off, actually, like how do you see this in the future rolling out with so much more content being delivered online and through channels like MotoGP.com, live feeds and all that kind of stuff, which have gotten really fantastic.
Yeah. Obviously there were teething problems at the first with those sorts of things, but you have to do it now. You simply have to do it. I think all major sports have woken up to it. And the likes of your Twitters, your Facebook, your podcasts, like your podcast, Jules, it's the future. It's people want to find their news about the sport. They want to find out things about the sport in different ways. And I think it's also new media is a really good way of getting young people into sports. And that I think that's crucial because they're obviously the people who are going to take over from. They're going to be the next generation of people who are promoting and pushing the sport for the future. So I am a big advocate that as much needs to be done in the new media front, but it's quite a hard thing because you've got old guard TV companies who also want to make sure they're paying a lot for TV rights and looking after their interests as well. And their sponsors and that kind of thing. And they're again, feeling their ways into different areas. But I don't know if you know, for example, in Europe now, the major broadcasts of MotoGP, whether it's the BBC in the UK or a TV in Spain or media set in Italy, they actually run the races live on their websites as well. So they, a lot of people from those countries don't even need to go to MotoGP.com because the TV companies who have the rights to the sports have their own platforms.
And they do their own commentary?
Well,
or do they run your feed?
On the websites, for Spain and Italy, obviously they have their own commentators. For BBC, they use myself and Nick's for the 125, 250s, and they have their own commentators for MotoGP. But, I think it's a good thing that TV companies are thinking, right, we have to open this up even further. And it will mean in the future that more people can see the races, and that's got to be a good thing. But I wish it was as easy as turning on the tap so that everyone could see it all the time. there are people in the US Speed pay to have MotoGP on their channel, so they want people to go to Speed to watch the races.
Right. So they can cut the commercial just at the crucial moment as a pass happens.
Like I would like to say, unfortunately, we're working actually over the years. We've talked to Speed about what can be done with the program. I know that behind the scenes they're trying to see what they can do, if there's some way of it, changing the system. So we'll have to wait and see for 2010. But we'll just see what's going on there. But there's always something trying to make sure that it's open to more people.
Right.
In a better format.
Yeah.
Because I honestly really feel if you listen to MotoGP.com, we focus with myself, Nick, and Ian in pit lane. A lot of our commentary is focused around doing something for the States, for the UK, and for Australia, which is where majority of people are viewing. And there's interviews with riders on the grid every single week, and we always feel that you're missing out on them if they condense the program too much. So it's a real shame, but you'll hear it because you'll be on the website.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that pre-race and the post-race stuff is some of the most fascinating stuff that we get to see on the on the website that we don't get to see on the TV.
Yeah. But again, it's all down to commercial reasons. And I wish it was different. I wish it could be that we could have a whole afternoon on Speed of MotoGP and you could see it from start to finish. But again, they've got to look after, they're the ones who are doing the number crunching on their side. And that's why we do things like the website. And that's why we do things like After the Flag to try and make sure that everyone gets access to some, more in-depth and detailed information.
Cool. All right. When are you getting back to work?
We're always working. We're still going on now, finishing up the season, just finished all the season review videos for this year. They're all now in the shops. And then at the beginning of January, it will all start for presentations of teams. I think Ducati presenting in the mountains in the middle of January. And then it's all systems go. It's a bit different this year because, of course, not as much tests. So we're all a bit more, what not too much to report on at the moment. So, right. It's not. I think it's going to be a strange off season, but we'll see.
Are you going to do some more commentary for the classic racing?
Yeah, we've done a load of those as well. So there should be a lot more of those going live in the new year as well. They've been great. They've been really good fun to do.
I was just going to ask, because you've seen these races before. Some of them you have, some of them you haven't, but you're commentating on them as if it's happening in real time.
We thought that was important because we've done tons of research to make sure that we're as if we're there. Mm-hmm. And some of them we were there as well. Right. so you were there. It's just that it wasn't a lot of them weren't necessarily recorded or they were held by host broadcasters, that kind of thing. So we thought, okay, we'll do them all. So they've got better graphics on them. They also have better quality audio and that kind of thing because some of the older ones don't necessarily have great quality audio, so they've been really good to see and go back to, and you know what I've seen from a lot of those is while there's all these changes, the racing is still being, it was great then and it's great now, and it's not similar, but there's still the great races do pop up year in, year out, and I think that's what I really enjoyed seeing.
Right on. All right, thanks Gavin, take care of the throat.
And, thanks very much, Jules.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll talk to you sometime next season.
Yeah, and keep going strong with the podcast. Cool, you guys did a great job.
Thanks, man.
All right. Cheers.
Bye. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gavin Emmett, for coming on the show. Gavin actually was stuck in traffic this morning when we were supposed to do it, and he rushed home to do the interview. So really appreciate that. And it was really fun talking to him. Hope to have him on the show again.
It is very cool because Gavin is not only a fan of MotoGPOD and pays attention to the show, but he's also a fan of RideOn2.com. And it's like, wow, he's actually paying attention to the stuff that we do. It's like,
well, he definitely gets the whole new media thing. Like, he knows that this isn't anymore about just television and magazines, you know.
Absolutely.
And he's, you know, he was very active in the MotoGP.com website since pretty much the beginning.
I've actually tweeted back and forth with him during races.
Oh, really? Nice. While he's doing the announcing? That's awesome.
So, he gets it.
Very cool. All right. So we are going away for a few weeks, but before we do, we've got Scott Jones sent. So he sent one calendar to give away last week, but then he decided to send two more. So these are the calendars we talked about last week. They're really nice, really sweet calendars
awesome.
With all sorts of information in them and great photos. And we have three of them. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask four questions. You have to answer all four because they're all related.
And get them right.
They have to, yeah.
And I didn't come up with it. I would like to point out that I didn't come up with this, but I fully approve the evil nature of it. It's a great series of questions because it's going to be hard.
Yeah, it'll be hard, but I'm sure a lot of people will be clear. You're not allowed to use Google, by the way. Yeah. And then you need to send in – this is going to be part of the test, by the way. You need to send the answers into 2010calendar@motogpod.com. If you send it into MotoGPOD@MotoGP.com, you will be disqualified. Mm-hmm. So send it to 2010calendar@MotoGPOD.com. It'll be in the show notes, your email address. We will announce. Basically, what we'll do is, you know, if we get more than three correct answers, we'll do a drawing during the January 8th episode when we come back.
Unpaid employees of MotoGPOD.com are not eligible, right?
That is correct. Okay, here are the questions. The first question is, what year did motorcycle Grand Prix racing first take place?
I know that.
I think a lot of people will know. Well, this is going to get, you know, progressively harder.
All right.
What is the one track that has been on the calendar since motorcycle Grand Prix racing started in that year?
I know that too.
Yeah. Who was the first 500cc class winner at that track?
I've got no clue.
Not the first winner of the first race, but the first winner of the race at that track.
Does that include sidecars?
No, this is a 500cc class, GP class.
500cc sidecars.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think that's considered part of the championship, was it?
Yeah, it was.
Well, damn you, Jim Race. We're talking about motorcycles, not trikes.
Hey, sidecars are badass.
I know.
Dude.
I freaking love those things.
Yes, no, it does not include sidecars. I just said like mess up tools.
Okay, so what year did Grand Prix racing start? What track has been there the whole time? At that track, who was the first winner that first year? And what position did this rider finish it in the championship at the end of the year? So those are the four questions. And like I said, just send them in to 2010calendar@MotoGP.com, MotoGPOD.com, and we'll if there's more than three correct answers, then we'll do a drawing. Good luck. These calendars are really cool, by the way. And if you don't if you don't know the answer, then just go and buy one.
Yeah, exactly. From motomatters.com. We'll put those questions up just because, you know, we chatter through them and some of it might not be too clear. And we know that when we ask you guys questions that we always kind of chatter through it and confuse you at the same time. So, yeah, no, that's
sidecars.
That's, what? So, yeah, no, I sent you those 99 photos from Laguna today. You saw all the sidecars in that.
Yep.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. Back in the day.
But anyway, it's time to go. We're going to be gone until January 8th. So have a great holiday. Enjoy the winter. If you're in the southern hemisphere, enjoy your summer, you bastards. And we'll see you in 2010.
And while we're going away, we are still available, obviously, via email.
Yeah, yeah.
Not maybe as available as we've been this last week. My God. These people. But thank you. And thank you, Jules, because you took the time to respond to most all of these folks. And I felt it literally was like an avalanche. I got buried and I'm like, holy cow, I don't know if I can even deal with this. So keep it up. Thank you for writing in and continue to do so. And write on and write on too.
Yeah, happy new year.
All right. Absolutely.
Thank you.